from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, I'm Judy Campbell, and today for Dave Iverson. Picture the stock market. A ticker tape scroll may come to mind, or perhaps a hive of brokers yelling on a trading floor. It doesn't really matter, because according to author Michael Lewis, that's just a yellowing photograph of a market now dead. The real U.S. stock market now trades unseen. The scroll of stock prices we see doesn't actually represent the market. It's the public face of a financial system that, Lewis says, is in truth only glimpsed by a select few who use that information to prey on investors. Lewis's new book, Flash Boys, takes on the hidden world of high-frequency trading and a band of Wall Street insiders fighting to bring fairness to the system. That's next on Forum. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, in today for Dave Iverson. Berkeley-based author Michael Lewis has sorted through the complexities and wrongdoings of the financial world before and turned it into an engaging, understandable story. Liar's Poker described his experiences as a bond salesman on Wall Street in the late 80s, and The Big Short dug into the housing and credit bubble and the roots of the financial crisis. His new book, Flash Boys, takes on a world hidden even to many Wall Street insiders, called high-frequency trading, and the central role Lewis followed, the central role it played in what he says is a stock market that is rigged for the benefit of a handful of insiders. Michael Lewis, welcome back to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So you start your book with an incredible story about the installation of a fiber optic cable to connect Chicago and New York. It's this epic, just a hugely expensive, almost impossible project boring through mountains. It reminded me of the building of the railroads, but it's done in total secrecy. And it makes clear this obsession that's just at the center of the story you're telling in the new financial world for speed.
You know, it was amazing to me that someone could dig a tunnel from an exchange in Chicago to an exchange in New Jersey without anybody knowing what it was for. That's what interested me that in the first place. But yes, the story briefly is as follows. A trader on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange noticed this obsession with speed starting to develop in kind of 2007, 2008, and he realized that the high-speed traders who were trading between Chicago and New Jersey had a line that was inefficient. It was a Verizon wireless line, and a signal to go back and forth between the two places took about 16 milliseconds. So a millisecond is a thousandth of a second. It takes 100 milliseconds to blink your eye. But 16 milliseconds seems slow to him, because if you kind of ran a straight line fiber between Chicago and New Jersey, you could do it in 10 or 11. And so he conceived this idea that he's gonna raise several hundred million dollars in total secrecy and dig a straight line between the two places. And he not only kind of blows through mountains, he has to, you know, he's going through farmers' fields and underneath people's parking lots and in the public right away a lot of the places. And people, as far as people, you go to, the big problem is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is hard to draw a straight line through with the fiber optic cable because of the way the mountains run. And you go through Pennsylvania now and ask people what that fiber is, and they say, oh, it's a high-speed internet connection. It's for internet access for colleges. They had all these stories they told themselves where they didn't realize what it was really for was to enable predatory activity in the stock market. And in particular, what it does for high-frequency traders is, I mean, it does many things, I think. But I think the big one is that when the stock market moves, like goes up or down, it goes up or down first in Chicago in the futures exchange. And if you are supposedly making markets in stocks in New Jersey, and you can find out the market's about to go up or go down, you can essentially get in front of the whole market.
And so explain that just a little more. So there is you're trying to narrow the time between these just some people are getting access to this very high speed line. While the rest of I'm glad we got you on a good studio line now, and the rest of the people are behind, and those are the people who are being taken advantage of.
Correct. I'm under the impression that maybe you didn't even hear what I just said.
I think we just had trouble. Yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. All right. So should I start from the beginning, or should I bore everybody, or should I?
No. All right. So, we heard of well. All right, so go ahead.
Okay, I'll go ahead. All right, so the Dan Spivey, the guy who, the traitor in Chicago, who sees that there isn't the fastest possible line.
Well, I'm so sorry. We did get that whole story. Don't worry. We just had a change in line for a second, but I think we got where you were. I wonder if you could just tell to get to this sense of what high speed is used for. I'd like you to get into your main character. You tell this story through the experiences of a very different Wall Street guy than we're used to hearing about. He's probably more, I guess, on the lamb side than the wolf side of Wall Street. He's polite. He's not greedy. He's Canadian. Brad Katsuyama, tell us about him and the moment he realized that something had changed in the system.
So Brad Katsuyama was sent from Canada by the Royal Bank of Canada to be a trader in New York. And he ran their stock market trading department. And the Royal Bank of Canada is sort of a second tier Wall Street firm and known mainly for being nice. You know, it's not on the sharp end of Wall Street in a lot of ways. I mean, so Brad's job was to essentially take risk in the stock market on behalf of investors. So, you know, you're a big mutual fund and you want to unload a million shares of Microsoft, and there's not a market for it in the public markets. It's, you know, that's a lot of shares to sell. He would take it off the hands of the big mutual fund and take the risk of parceling it out over time. And so he's sitting, you know, he's very sensitive to what's going on in the stock market. In 2008, he notices the stock market has changed in some really fundamental way that he does not understand. Previously, he's sitting in his desk and he looks at his trading screens and he wants to buy, say, you know, 50,000 shares of Microsoft. And he can see that there are 50,000 shares of Microsoft in the market and they're offered for $20 a share. And he can hit a button on his desk in his computer terminal and he just buys. In 2008, all of a sudden, when he hits the button to buy the 50,000 shares of Microsoft that are out in the stock markets, the markets vanish. It's like the people who seem to be offering the Microsoft shares don't offer them anymore, and the price goes up. And it's like someone knows he's doing it and is getting out in front of him and beating him to it. But he doesn't understand why. I mean, he really thinks in the beginning he's like bashing the sides of his computer with his fist. He thinks he calls tech support.
Right.
So the tech support comes out and says, you know, they don't understand. They think the problem is him. They
as
think
IT
your finger's too
guys
slow.
Usually do, right?
Yeah, they say, yeah, that's right. They say your finger's too slow. You got to push the button faster. That kind of stuff. And finally, the most sophisticated explanation he gets from the most senior kind of tech guys inside the bank is that, hey, you're not the only one who's trying to buy those Microsoft shares that are out there in the public stock markets. Then, you know, other people must just be beating you to them when you hit the button. And you know, there's a lot going on whenever you're trading. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, you don't understand. They only disappear when I'm trying to buy them. And they don't get this. And he says, watch. So he makes them all stand behind him. And he says, all right, we're looking at the screens. There are 13 public stock markets. You can see that in these 13 public stock markets, there are like 10,000 shares of Microsoft offered at $20 a share. Nothing's happening in Microsoft. No movement. It looks like they're still there. They're still there. He says, now watch. He hits the button and the Microsoft shares go away. And so he says, which you don't understand, I'm the event, he realized. He realized that he was the cause of the activity that was happening in the market.
That and someone was spotting what he was doing and acting on that.
So there was a new predator in the market. That's what he thought. He thought there's some new and he felt like the prey. And so his first impulse, you know, the simple story is that I've written is one guy figuring out, who thought he knew how the stock market worked and had every reason to think he knew how the stock market worked, figuring out that he's the prey in the stock market. And he's trying to figure out first how not to be the prey. And once he figures out what's going on, he tries to basically go out and destroy the predator. And in the process, gives you a description of how the stock market now works.
And which took him quite a long time to figure out. It was incredibly complicated.
Well, it's still going on. This is the amazing thing. I mean, how can we live in a society where our stock market is secretive, where people can't understand how it works? But he has spent the better part of the last 5 years in a kind of almost a detective-like search of how the inner workings of the stock market. And he has access to the information that a big bank would. And then he's left the big bank and created his own stock exchange. So he has the information that you get, kind of information you get if you run a stock exchange. But he realized pretty quickly that he wasn't going to get very far himself because, you know, he's a guy who basically doesn't have any interest in programming his own DVD, I mean, player. He doesn't have a technical background. And so he draws in people from all over the financial system, people from high-frequency trading firms and from stock exchanges and from big banks. And he assembles a portrait of the market through these people.
And as he starts to do this, you have this quote here that I want to read. It's starting to dawn on him what's happening. The U.S. stock market, this is a quote from the book from you. The U.S. stock market was now a class system rooted in speed of haves and have-nots. The haves paid for nanoseconds. The have-nots had no idea that a nanosecond had value. The haves enjoyed a perfect view of the market. The have-nots never saw the market at all. What had once been the world's most public, most democratic financial market had become in spirit something more like a private viewing of a stolen work of art. So that was a big, big realization for a guy who basically trusted the system.
Yes. I mean, in his what fuels his mistrust is that all of this is occurring in the heat of the financial crisis, where he's looking around saying, "What on earth did Wall Street just do?" And the Royal Bank of Canada didn't do it, so he was a little oblivious to what was going on inside of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and so on and so forth. But what he comes to realize is that essentially the stock market has created a new ecosystem inside of it, and the point of the ecosystem is to generate money for Wall Street, for intermediaries, and that it's kind of this elaborate and rigged game. It isn't like they're just smarter traders who are faster than him in the market. That's not the problem. The problem is that every investor has his problem. I mean, everybody from the most sophisticated hedge funds to a retail investor trading stock on E-Trade or TD Ameritrade, that they are all at a speed disadvantage to a handful of people who the exchanges sell special access to. And to whom the banks and the brokers who handle stock market orders sell their customers' orders so they can execute against them, to basically exploit them.
Right. So the stock exchanges are selling this access. I mean, and the stories you tell about the access are amazing. I mean, people are jockeying and paying a lot of money just to move a computer a little closer to in a room to the exchange, right? Where their cable is located, they want to run it across the middle of the room instead of along the walls. People are going through huge amounts of effort to just shave off the tiniest amounts of speed.
They're paying for feet inside the exchange, and in addition, they're doing it in complete stealth. So this isn't an open and honest process. This is a process where people are like draping their computers with gauze, so that nobody knows whose computers they are. And a lot of effort goes into just sort of hiding what's going on, which makes the search that Brad Katsuyama goes on, you know, ever more difficult. It's like not like people want to tell him how it all works. He has to go kind of dig it out.
Well, and though you talked about the stock exchanges, and the role of stock exchanges is really interesting here because this is what's allowing all this to happen is that we have, is it 13 stock exchanges or are there?
You know, it's so here, you're right. So it's 13. There's 13 public exchanges and they're all in New Jersey. There are basically four different sites in New Jersey. And then there are another 40 something essentially private stock exchanges called dark pools that are controlled, run by mainly the big banks. All of these exchanges are one way or another owned by financial intermediaries, and I think that's the key. I think, you know, there are lots of sort of morals to the story, but one of the morals that Brad Katsuyama quickly figures out is that the reason the system's gotten so screwed up, it's the reason the system got so screwed up during the financial crisis, during the subprime mortgage crisis, is that the incentives are very screwed up, that the exchanges are owned by intermediaries, the exchanges that are really meant to just be for investors, that they're just, what is our stock market? Our stock market is supposed to channel capital to productive enterprise so it can be invested and create jobs and grow the economy and so on and so forth. It doesn't exist for the benefit, or not meant to exist, for the benefit of the middlemen who take, you know, money from one pocket and put it in another pocket. But the exchanges are all owned by the intermediaries, and he realized that that is part of the problem. And it is because of their ownership and because they've become more frantically for-profit organizations in the last decade or so, they have found themselves catering to the needs of high-frequency traders more than anybody else. And they organize, they're constantly responding to the demands of a subset of the world.
But one thing that's interesting is that this problem was created, right? I mean, before 2005, there was just the New York Stock Exchange that handled most of the stock trading. Then about 15% was handled on NASDAQ. And the reason we got more stock exchanges is because the SEC was worried about cronyism. They were trying to solve problems of self-interest, of greed.
You know, this is funny. So Brad Katsuyama ends up hiring a man who works, who's kind of deep from the bowels of the Bank of America Corporation, named John Schwall. And John Schwall asks himself, when he realizes what's going on in the stock exchanges, and he realizes that they've been set up to create a disadvantage in favor of the Wall Street intermediary vis-a-vis the ordinary investor. And he asks, how does this happen? And he starts to dig into the history of regulation of the stock market, and he realizes that this has always happened. That what has happened in the stock market today is a result of regulation that was put in place to try to curb the abuses of the stock market yesterday. So I don't, you know, nobody's under the illusion that the stock market was once upon a time a totally clean and honest and fair place. The bigger point is that what's happened on Wall Street is technology has hit it and transformed it. Information technology has essentially eliminated the need for a lot of what Wall Street used to do, and Wall Street has, and we could be living in a world in which buyers and sellers were meeting together in a single computer without the help of Wall Street, without any intermediation. What Wall Street has managed to do is insert itself in the process where it doesn't belong in a new way. It's not that the stock market is worse than it's ever been before. It's just a lot worse than it should be.
Well, you profile, I mean, it's a very unusual story. You are profiling this group led by Brad Katsuyama's. They try and figure out what's going on in the market. They try to fix it, leading them to start their own stock exchange. It's a bold move.
Well, it is a bold move, but what they're doing is it ends up being almost a political act. It's an act of entrepreneurship. I mean, they're essentially what they decide is. So when Brad Katsuyama figures out that the stock market is basically rigged, that there are people, that there's systematic exploitation going on, and he doesn't get to the bottom at first of all the predatory activity that's going on, but he has a pretty good picture of kinds of predatory activity that are just outrageous. He says to his bosses in Canada, at our Royal Bank of Canada, we need to go on a public educational campaign. We need to go tell investors what's going on, and hoping that the investors will be so outraged that they'll force the Wall Street banks and the exchanges to reform. And the superiors in Canada say, well, the nice thing to do is to go tell the U.S. government and the SEC before we go and broadcast this. So he makes a trip to the SEC to describe what he's found. And what he finds in the SEC is that there's a kind of indifference to it, that he comes away from meeting with the SEC pretty much convinced that the U.S. regulatory process is never going to deal with the problem. So he has to do something else to deal with the problem. I mean, in the same world, right, what would happen? In the same world, our government would come in and say, you can't have speed advantage on a stock exchange. You're not allowed to know the prices of stocks before everybody else. You're not allowed to trade against innocent investors at old stock market prices that disadvantage them. So they don't do, but that, he sees that's not going to happen, that the world's not sane. So he comes up with this, it's a market solution. I'm going to create an exchange on which every dollar has the same chance. Every investor coming in is treated the same, and then I'm going to broadcast it. And then the world has a choice, and investors will, he hopes, sort of mobilize and move and insist on moving their orders onto his exchange.
But it is not an easy sell to get people onto his exchange.
The reason it's not an easy sell, and it partly explains why the problem exists in the first place, is that all stock market orders are handled by either the banks or online brokerage houses. I mean, 70% of all U.S. stock market orders go through the hands of the two big to fail banks, all the biggest eight banks on Wall Street. And the investors have a very, very hard time of knowing what the banks are doing with their orders. I mean, it's not inconceivable, for example, that a huge investor like a Fidelity even, or a T. Rowe Price, would say to a big bank like Morgan Stanley or Credit Suisse, send all my orders onto IEX, and the bank could surreptitiously or handle the thing in such a way where it didn't happen. So he's got a problem. He's got to persuade the banks to cooperate in essentially destroying their own revenues. So that's a problem. But in order to do this, what does he have to do? He has to create a kind of culture war inside of Wall Street. He has to mobilize and organize the world's biggest money managers to take on the big Wall Street banks, which they do not do naturally or happily.
But they are shocked by the story he's told them.
Well, this is the thing. You know, if you ask me, like, at what point did I think, oh, my God, this is a book? It was when I realized after talking to some investors, I mean, really sophisticated investors, that this 32-year-old Canadian, after, like, diligently digging into the U.S. stock market, was the only one who could explain to them how the market worked. And that they themselves did not know. They all knew something was wrong. They were all aware that all of a sudden their orders seemed to be anticipated, to put it politely, and that it was getting more and more expensive for them to go and buy big or sell big blocks of stocks because the price would move the minute they tried to do it. Even if it seemed as though that the stock was available on the marketplace at a certain price. So the funniest response I got was, so Bill Ackman is a hedge fund manager who buys and sells chunks of companies. And he told me, he said, before Brad walked into his office, he thought that he had an insider trading problem. He thought someone in his firm might be leaking information about the companies he wanted to buy or sell into the market some way or other. And so that was the texture of the problem. Brad explains to them, no, it's actually in the structure of the market. It's actually in the pipes. It's actually how the boxes are laid out in the exchanges and how the fiber runs through New Jersey and how it runs between New Jersey and Chicago. When he lays this out, they are floored. And he's able to, I mean, he's able to mobilize Capital Group, T. Rowe Price, Vanguard. I mean, one after another ally themselves with him. And so in the end, he creates pressure on Wall Street.
We're going to continue our conversation with Michael Lewis after a short break. And if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Judy Campbell, sitting in for Dave Iverson, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, in for Dave Iverson. We're talking with author Michael Lewis about his new book, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. And before we went to the break, you were talking about the reaction of investors. And that's one of the remarkable things in this book. I think people are used to feeling like they've been duped by Wall Street. People feel like they're getting ripped off all the time or the system's rigged. But the question of who inside knew. They had to assembling a group of people from all these disparate parts of Wall Street to try and piece together a story that it seems very few people knew. So who knew? Who is responsible? Who knew?
Well, the answer is it's hard to know, and I tell you why it's hard to know, because the technologists who were at the heart of the new system, who are running high frequency trading firms, for example, a lot of the individuals have pieces of the puzzle. They have some narrow specialty that they perform and some task they perform in the puzzle, but do not have a larger context. And this is one of the things that struck Brad Katsuyama as he starts to kind of pull people in from various parts of the system to hire them to help him figure out how to basically destroy the system, is that the individuals are kind of oblivious to the consequences of what they're doing. Now, that's obviously not true of everybody. And there's probably a list of, 50 to 100 people we could compile who have some knowledge of the kind of some global picture. But those people are totally silent. I mean, they're very hard to get to. And this is like a theme that runs through the story, is just secrecy. I mean, that someone's digging a tunnel from Chicago to New Jersey totally in secret, that people are putting their computers into stock exchanges totally in secret, that the firms that are generating the profits from the trading are essentially proprietary firms that aren't publishing results. No one really knows how much money they're making. All that's known is that a couple of glimpses inside these places we've had, they never lose money. They make money every day trading, which suggests they're not taking any risk. So it's like the names of the people who knew wouldn't mean anything to you, even if I name them. And I'm kind of reluctant to, and I tell you why. Because the minute you put a name on it, it ceases to be about the system and becomes about a person. And it really, this story is not about a person. It's about a really screwed up financial system. And the system, it's broken. It needs to be fixed. The relationship between Wall Street and the rest of the society needs to be repaired. And that is what Brad Katsuyama is here to do.
Now, there have been several investigations that are launched into high-frequency trading, now ongoing. There's an FBI investigation, SEC investigation, and now just today, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced an investigation that his office was launching, an investigation into high-frequency stock trading.
I can confirm that we at the United States Department of Justice are investigating this practice to determine whether it violates insider trading laws. The department is committed to ensuring the integrity of our financial markets, and we are determined to follow this investigation wherever the facts and the law may lead.
And what do you think the result of these investigations will be? What's your prediction? And what reforms or changes could come out of it and could help?
Well, so right now, what do we know? We know the New York Attorney General, the FBI, and the Department of Justice all in the last couple of weeks have announced investigations. And the SEC seems to be perking up. And it's kind of interesting to imagine them all working together on this. I mean, I don't know, in parallel. But the angle, I haven't spoken to any of these people. So I don't know what their angle into the matter is. My fear is that what happens is they just find a couple of examples of people to lynch and the system doesn't really change. My other fear is that some superficial reform takes place that doesn't actually deal with the problem, much like the subprime crisis. The reform that came on the back of the financial crisis didn't really address the deep incentive problems on Wall Street. So what would be good if it happened? It would be really good if there were attempts to make the financial system much more transparent. So let's take this in the stock market. As an investor, you really do not know what happens to your stock market order. And you have very little ability to control your stock market order. I mean, I would bet that most of the customers of E-Trade or TD Ameritrade do not know that their online broker auctions their information, auctions their stock market orders to high-frequency traders collectively hundreds of millions of dollars a year to trade against them. And you know, it raising an obvious question: why would anybody pay money to execute a stock market order? I mean, this is not a good situation. And the addition of transparency, I think, will create political pressure. It will also create market pressure. I mean, that you got this new exchange, IEX, that Brad Katsuyama has built, that has been built with a view only to prevent predatory activity, to make it a fair place. That if there's pressure from investors to move their orders onto his exchange, that will force change in the market, and it's happening. I mean, it's riveting what's happening. Actually, Goldman Sachs, the leading investment bank, has flipped in the last 4 or 5 months and essentially abandoned what appeared to be an attempt to build itself into a high frequency trading firm, and thrown its support behind IEX and is directing its customer orders, investors' orders onto IEX. Charles Schwab yesterday issued a press release saying that he thought that high frequency trading was a cancer that needed to be attacked. I think given the way our society seems to work and its inability to like make its government work well because we're so suspicious of our government, among other reasons, I'm worried about a regulatory solution, because I think that the likely regulatory solution is a kind of half-assed one that leaves lots of room for predatory activity. It just creates another regulation that could be gamed. Whereas a market solution is an interesting one. You have a market solution where essentially all the exchanges that have sold out investors' interests collapse. That would be neat. Where businesses that have brokers that have represented themselves as representing the interests of their customers lose money, their share prices go down, and they're forced to behave because there's a good actor in the marketplace. Well, that would be neat too.
But to make this good actor in the marketplace, I mean, these were people who turned their back on self-interest, at least in the short term. They walked away from a lot of money that they could have made capitalizing from this system to try and set up a system that was fair. I mean, it's this enormous financial market. It's this huge system that was kind of relying, from the story you tell, on the good graces of some insiders who felt that they didn't like the taste of what was being done.
No, it's remarkable, the serendipity of life, that person, that Brad Katsuyama was the person, is the messenger, that he's the person who's willing to walk away from, you know, a multi-million-dollar-a-year job that's totally safe, in a bank where he's thought to be a guy who might run the whole place one day, to start a business that you know, really, is any new exchange likely to succeed? Probably not. But to take that kind of risk, and that to attract to himself a similar spirited sort of person. I mean, these guys work in an office overlooking the World Trade Center site, and there may be 40 people in the place. And every one of the people there walked away from some job that paid them more and that was safe, because they sensed something was wrong with the system they were working in, and they wanted to help fix the system. Now, they will be rewarded amply if they succeed. But I think any shrewd, like financial person, any Wall Street person looking at what they've done thinks they're insane, because they're walking away from sure fortune into a very uncertain future. And in the bargain, they've managed to alienate their industry. I mean, Brad Katsuyama has said to me many times, I had to decide that it would be okay if I just never worked on Wall Street again, because I might be unemployable at the end of this because everybody hates me.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're talking with Michael Lewis, author of Flash Boys. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org, or put them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Alex from Oakland, please join us.
Thank you. Quick question here. Why are so many prominent academicians claiming that this high-frequency trading provides liquidity to the market?
So the academic literature is very, collectively, is very skeptical and in some cases coruscating about high-frequency trading. So there's certainly not like a consensus in academia that that high frequency trading is good for the market. I would say the short answer to your question is that is, you know, part of the propaganda offensive that comes out of the HFT world is, one, it's not illegal. We're all working within the law. And two, we add liquidity. And when I hear a Wall Street person say, when I hear a Wall Street person use the word liquidity, my suspicion just goes through the roof. Because what does it mean? And so what does that word mean? I mean, I think what it means is that a market is liquid to the extent you can cash out of it. You can get your money back. But it doesn't mean that in high-frequency trading. High-frequency trading is not adding to the stock market's ability to get your cash out of it. What it's doing is adding to volume in the market. In a way, a front runner adds to volume. I mean, they're essentially half the market, HFT, as you expect them to be if they were doing nothing but front running. I mean, you add a front runner to a market, a scalper, who puts himself between the natural buyers and sellers who otherwise don't need him. And what do? You double the volume in the marketplace. So they point to the volume they add and they say, this is liquidity. But how can it be liquidity? They take no market risk. They take no positions at the end of the day. They aren't serving the buffering function that old-fashioned traders, you know, for all their sins, served. I mean, it's funny to compare, actually, the role of the high-frequency trader in a stock market to the old specialists in the New York Stock Exchange. Now, the specialists, of course, had their vices, but they were in a position where they were expected to buy in a falling market and sell in a rising one. They hated volatility in the markets because you didn't want to be buying in a falling market, but they had some obligation to supply capital to the market. The high-frequency traders do the opposite. They get advance word of whether the market's falling or rising, and they get out. They sell in a falling market and they buy in a rising one. They have no obligation to do anything but that. I'm rambling because this is important. I think it's an important question. It's like this illusion that some people have bought into the idea that volume is liquidity and it's not.
Well, you raise the issue of volatility, which is interesting, too. I mean, because you're talking about these incredibly high speed transactions. So it seems remarkable that by having a very tiny advantage that the market is moving so much now that it can really be capitalized on.
Yeah, so let's talk about what it's very important when you're trying to understand why the financial markets behave the way they do, to ask what are the incentives of the principal players inside of it. So what is the incentive of a high-frequency trader? How does he want the market to be? So unlike the specialists who don't want it to be volatile, they quite like volatility, high-frequency traders. Why do they like volatility? Well, what do they have? What opportunity does their faster speed provide them with? It provides them with the ability to trade at a different price than the real price. They get to trade at yesterday's price, knowing what today's price is. But yesterday is two milliseconds ago. I mean, they have a 2 or 3 millisecond advantage. So what they really like is movement in price in that 2 or 3 milliseconds. If you're stuck with the price 3 milliseconds ago, or put yourself in the position of the high frequency trader, you're sitting there for the order from, you know, Ameritrade or for that matter from Goldman Sachs or whoever, and you know the order says investor X wants to buy Microsoft at $30 a share. What you really hope in those 2 milliseconds is that Microsoft goes down to 29.9 and you can buy it and then sell it to the investor at 30. So the incentive of the intermediary, of the chief intermediary in the stock market right now, is to maximize volatility. They like volatility. So it's not surprising that when you start looking at intraday volatility that you see it surprisingly high.
Let's go to Scott in Menlo Park. Hi, Scott. Join us.
Hi. I'm interested in, and maybe I missed it when I was talking to the screener, but how is it that the high-frequency traders get a hold of the information on a trade before it's executed? That particular step in there I'm missing. And number two, do you have any special security measures to – you've got a lot of very valuable axes here.
So So the second question was, were there any regulatory measures I'd encourage? Is that the second question?
No, I think
he's worried about your safety and security after writing this book.
let me answer the second question first. I feel safest after the book has come out. I actually worried a bit about the people at IX. Not too seriously, but before the book came out, before it was their role was really publicly known, they had threats. I mean, they had a threat of violence from one of the big banks, and they are, you know, they're in a really curious position. I mean, they are an effective Occupy Wall Street. It's a market-based solution to the problem of Wall Street behavior, and they are actively trying to change behavior and at the same time suck billions of dollars of revenues out of Wall Street. And I just don't think that happens without a fight. So they don't have a special security, but I worry more about them than me, because someone was going to tell their story.
And the other part of his question was
how do you
explaining
tell?
How it does. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a really complicated. I mean, I think the honest answer, it's a really complicated question because it's the. But let me give you. Let me proceed with an example of one way high frequency traders are able to anticipate orders. But the simple answer is they're given the right to execute them. They buy the right. They buy access to the orders, and they execute them themselves. They trade against them, and they're able to trade against them on a slow market. But let me give you an example of the sort of thing that happens, because it's not just one form of predation. It's not one form of predatory activity. When Brad Katsuyama was the hero of the story was first discovering that he was being front run, and he tries to figure out what's happening, how are they finding out what I want to do? He after a year of investigation with the help of a lot of different kinds of people, he realizes that the problem is I'm sitting at a desk in Lower Manhattan. When I hit the button on my computer to buy, my computer sends a signal to buy into the market. But how does it do that? Does that through fiber optics that run up the West Side Highway of Manhattan and through the Lincoln Tunnel into New Jersey, where there are all the 13 stock exchanges are scattered. But the first exchange it arrives at is the BATS stock exchange, the BATS stock exchange, right on the other side in Weehawken, on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel. There are waiting high-frequency traders with small buy and sell orders in the markets for every stock who are able to divine that I've got a biggish buy order. They race me to the other 12 exchanges and buy up the stock in front of me before I get there. They're able to beat me there because they've carved their own fiber optic path through New Jersey to the other exchanges and have faster routes. So in this case, the way they find out is simply by physically intercepting the signal on its way to most of the exchanges at the exchange that's closest to the signal's origin.
And we should point out, I don't think we've said yet, that the new trade, IEX, the new stock exchange, deals with this problem by slowing everybody down before they come in. So it's acting
here's what they do. Because I think it sounds Luddite-ish and it sounds like, oh, maybe they're making the markets less efficient and all the rest. What they do is they don't allow people to stick their computers right next to their exchange computer so they have faster access. What they also do is they coil 60 kilometers of fiber optics in a box between themselves and the high-frequency traders, effectively putting the high-frequency traders 60 kilometers away from the exchange, which slows it down by, get this, like 250 microseconds. A microsecond is a thousandth of a millisecond. So you're talking about infinitesimal periods of time, like meaningless periods of time for everybody except high frequency traders. It doesn't disrupt the market, but that's how they do it. That's right. They essentially require them. They take the responsibility as an exchange for making the experience fair for all investors.
Okay, Gil joins us from Richmond. Hi, join us, Gil.
Yes, Mr. Lewis. Thank you for your very important book. I'm wondering if you've ever done any calculations on how this mega money transfer will affect the little guy. The little guy would be like he buys and sells ETFs or index funds, say, for $10,000 or $100,000. I personally can't understand how this will affect people like that a bit. Have you done the calculation?
And let me add to this, I want you to answer that question, that you have gotten criticism from people who say that really this doesn't affect the average person and it's really about big traders and it doesn't impact investors.
So there are several answers to this question. The first is the little guy is more than his money is managed in more than one way. The little guy is not just buying and selling 100 share lots through E-Trade. Most little guys' savings, middle class savings, are managed by big money managers. They're managed by mutual funds and pension funds and so on. So the little guy's interests are represented by the big guy. They aren't two separate interests. Second thing is, for the person who is actually sitting at his computer terminal and trading in 100 share lots, this isn't, you know, it's true that you're not the scalping side of this. The front-running side of this is trivial. I mean, it's pennies at most. That's not what should be irritating or disturbing to the little guy. And it's not even the most important point of the story, I don't think, the scalping. Overall, even though it might add up to, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year. I don't know how much it adds up to, but many billions of dollars a year. The scalping is the problem, the real problem, and what the little guy should be very interested in, is that in order for the system to maximize the take of high-frequency traders, who then share that take with the exchanges and the banks, it's had to make itself very, very complicated. And the complexity is all in the service of maximizing the number of collisions between high-frequency traders and ordinary investors. Now, in making itself complicated, it is all and fast for the benefit of a handful of participants. It has made itself a lot less stable. The symptoms of this instability are things like the flash crash, NASDAQ going out for hours, IPOs of Facebook, for example, getting screwed up, a stock market that is dysfunctional, technologically dysfunctional, and therefore less trustworthy. What is the consequence of a less trustworthy stock market? Big companies, productive companies, have to pay more for capital because capital is more expensive to raise. The economy is not as prosperous as it otherwise would be. This is a massive social issue. It is a symptom of a diseased relationship between Wall Street and the rest of the society. If all you are interested in is the 100 share lot you're trading at your computer terminal and you do not care about any of this other stuff, then this isn't your problem. But I doubt there are very many people like that.
Robert writes on our website, why does Mr. Lewis think high-frequency trade started in the 2000s? I was part of a team that deployed financial workstations at the New York Stock Exchange in the mid-90s. The IT personnel there were at that time well aware that these mechanisms were exploitable, whether or not they were being exploited at the time in this way, and that it was inevitable that they would be so exploited. The idea wasn't new even then.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the question.
Wondering why this started in the 2000s and not earlier. This has been a mechanism that could have been used.
Why is only 2008 that a trader on a stock market trader starts to notice these problems?
I think he's asking when it started.
So the real triggering mechanism was a regulation passed by the SEC called Reg NMS, and it's described at some length in the book. And I hate to make a hash of it here.
Okay.
But the gist of it is it led to much more fragmentation in the marketplace, and it forced investment stock market orders to travel around the marketplace a lot more in search of the other side of the trade than it used to.
And yet another example of regulations, well-intended regulations.
It was a very well-intended regulation, and nobody saw the consequences of it. And this whole thing sounds like a conspiracy. It really is an accidental conspiracy.
We're very short on time. Vic in Livermore, join us.
Morning. I'm a small guy. How do I move? I have a relationship with a traditional broker. How do I get onto the AEX? Is it the
IEX?
IEX.
So two quick things. One is there is a website called IamAnInvestor.org, which gives you. Will give you a description of your rights as an investor and how you can pressure whoever is handling your stock market orders to handle them in the way that you would like them to order. But you can handle them. You can just request and see what the odds that they're going to abide by that request to change vary with the broker you're dealing with. But if you go to the website, it will explain to you what you can do. IamAnInvestor.org.
And we'll slip in another call. John in San Jose. Join us, please.
Yes, real quick question. Is there any possibility that the computers themselves are acting on inside information without being touched by human hands?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah.
The computers don't do anything without people telling them what to do. So they don't have a mind of their own yet. What is probably happening, what the FBI and the Justice Department are interested in and why they're calling it insider trading is, one, is it insider trading to have advance word of the actual prices in the stock market from ahead of everybody else? And two, if you can get news from the Labor Department faster because you've built a faster line, is that insider trading? I don't know the answer to that. But is it possible the computers are acting on their own? I think that's unlikely.
All right. Thank you, Michael Lewis, so much for joining us. It's a complicated topic and a very readable story that you've written. You digesting a lot of complicated information in a narrative that is easy to follow. Michael Lewis is speaking at the Berkeley City Club on Saturday, May 3rd at 8 p.m. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Forum's produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Vinnie Tong. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Judy Campbell, in today for Dave Iverson. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.